the limelight. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has predicted there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration on a day when world leaders offered their congratulations to the president-elect Joe Biden. Mike Pompeo made his remarks to reporters at the State Department on Tuesday, 10th of November, and gave a slight smile after referring to a second Trump administration, leaving it unclear whether he was joking. The Secretary of State made no reference whatsoever to Joe Biden winning the U.S. election on 3rd of November when making remarks to reporters at the U.S. State Department. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Pompeo Makes Baseless Claims About Smooth Transition to Second Trump Administration. Stay with us for more of Julian Borger's article. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has predicted there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration on a day when world leaders offered their congratulations to the president-elect Joe Biden. Mike Pompeo made his remarks to reporters at the State Department on Tuesday, 10th of November, and gave a slight smile after referring to a second Trump administration, leaving it unclear as to whether he was joking. He did not refer to the fact that Joe Biden has been projected as the winner of the election and held a lead of more than 5 million nationwide in the vote count so far, whilst being ahead in the four critical battleground states. Pressed on the subject in a later radio interview, Mike Pompeo did acknowledge at least the possibility of a Democratic victory, saying, "On 20th of January, we'll have a transition. Whether it's to a Trump administration, a second Trump administration, as I spoke about today, or to an administration led by former Vice President Joe Biden." In his State Department remarks, Mike Pompeo focused on the various legal challenges being pursued by the Trump administration, none of which so far have been found to have any legal merit. "We're ready," Pompeo went out. "The world is watching what's taking place. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there will be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly. The world should have every confidence that the transition necessary to make sure that the State Department is functional today, successful today, and successful with a president who's in office on 20th of January, a minute after noon, will also be successful." The U.S. State Department is not currently communicating with the Biden team, and all government agencies have been told to proceed with their budgets as if Donald Trump had been re-elected to office, to the outrage of Democrats. Secretary of State Pompeo shouldn't play along with baseless and dangerous attacks on the legitimacy of last week's election, said Elliot Engel, a Democratic chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The State Department should now begin preparing for President-elect Biden's transition. Mike Pompeo said he was receiving calls from all across the world, but did not say from whom. The leaders of America's main allies, including Canada, Britain, France, Ireland, and Germany, have all congratulated Joe Biden in phone calls on Monday and Tuesday. "They understand that we have a legal process. They understand that this takes time," the Secretary of State said, comparing the situation now after the 2000 presidential election. Back in 2000, George W. Bush was leading by 537 votes in Florida when the Supreme Court intervened to stop the vote counting. Joe Biden is ahead by tens of thousands of votes in four critical states now. Echoing Donald Trump's line, which has become the Republican Party's line, Mike Pompeo said, "We must count every legal vote. We want to make sure that any vote that wasn't lawful ought not to be counted. That dilutes your vote. If it's done properly, got to get that right. When we get it right, we'll get it right. We're in good shape." When a journalist asked whether Donald Trump's refusal to concede discredits U.S. promotion of democratic norms abroad, Mike Pompeo replied irritably, "That's ridiculous, and you know it's ridiculous, and you've asked it because it's ridiculous." He added, "We want the law to be imposed in a way that reflects the reality of what took place, and that's what I think we're engaged in here in the United States, and it's what we work on every place all across the world." Meanwhile, President Trump continues to refuse to acknowledge the election result by baselessly claiming that Joe Biden's victory was won through voter fraud. Donald Trump is also calling on his base to pay off his re-election debts. President Trump is actively seeking donations from his supporters. Donations can be made to two different funds, Trump's personal fund and his joint fund with the RNC, the Republican National Committee. President Trump needs you to step up to make sure we have the resources to protect the integrity of the election, the wording of both funds says, which is featured in a huge pop-up on Donald Trump's re-election webpage. It continues, "Please contribute any amount immediately to the Official Election Defense Fund and to increase your impact by 1,000%. It is unclear who matches the donations, but if you scroll down past the information about the left-wing mob trying to undermine our election, you'll see some fine print. On Trump's personal fund, it dictates that all donations raised, only 50% will go towards a recount effort, and that 50% of each contribution, up to a maximum of $2,800, will be designated towards Donald Trump's 2020 general election account for general election debt retirement until such debt is retired. On his joint fund with the Republican National Committee, RNC, the donations work as follows. 60% of each contribution first to Save America, up to $5,000. Then to Donald Trump's recount account, up to a maximum of $2,800. And 40% of each contribution to the RNC's operating account, up to a maximum of $35,500. This essentially means that depending on the size of your donation, a large portion of any donation won't go to the recount bid, but will instead go to the super PAC supporting the bid and the Republican Party. Some people have complained of being repeatedly asked to give donations to Donald Trump's re-election effort, receiving as many as 28 messages in a day.
Aperture. At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total of 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917, when mustard gas is used for the first time, and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes, with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks, ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. We find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania, and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables, and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. and it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thioglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishes are not getting injured by fishing that substances up, and therefore we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia. Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm.
And we have manual, so we can have to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here. You have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The World Trade Organization had ruled that Boeing was given an unfair edge over Airbus by tax breaks from Washington State, where Boeing once had its headquarters. But after the World Trade Organization decision, the state repealed the tax breaks, making the EU's complaint obsolete in the view of US officials. US Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer said, "The United States is disappointed by the action taken by the European Union today," adding, "The alleged subsidy to Boeing was repealed 7 months ago. The European Union has long proclaimed its commitment to following WTO rules, but today's announcement shows they do so only when it's convenient to them." A year ago, the World Trade Organization ruled in a similar fashion in favor of the United States, allowing it to impose penalties on EU goods worth up to $7.5 billion, over European support for Boeing's rival, Airbus. After Donald Trump also imposed tariffs on EU steel and aluminium and threatened punitive duties on European cars, the Europeans had hoped that he would hold fire on the tariffs related to the Airbus-Boeing dispute. But having repeatedly failed to achieve a negotiated solution, the European Union decided to announce punishment of its own. We have prepared for you an article written by Lorne Cook. The piece is titled, EU Puts Tariffs on US, but Hopes for Change with New American Government. The article has been taken from the Associated Press website. Please stay with us for more of Lorne Cook's article. The European Union said it would impose tariffs on up to $4 billion worth of U.S. goods and services over illegal aid for plane maker Boeing, but expressed hope that trade ties would improve once new U.S. President Joe Biden takes office. European trade ministers agreed on the move a few weeks ago after international arbitrators gave the EU the green light for such punitive action. The World Trade Organization, WTO, had deemed illegal some U.S. support for Boeing, which is a bitter rival to Europe's Airbus, and said the EU could make up for that with a limited amount of penalties on U.S. trade. EU Commission Executive Vice President Valdis Dombrovskis said on Monday, 9th of November, "Regrettably, in spite of our best efforts due to the lack of progress from the U.S. side, we can confirm that the European Union will later today exercise our rights and impose countermeasures awarded to us by the WTO. The WTO had ruled that Boeing was given an unfair edge over Airbus by tax breaks from Washington State, where Boeing once had its headquarters. But after the World Trade Organization WTO decision, the state repealed the tax breaks, making the EU's complaint obsolete in view of US officials. America's trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, said, "The United States is disappointed by the action taken by the European Union today." Lighthizer added, "The alleged subsidy to Boeing was repealed 7 months ago. The EU has long proclaimed its commitment to following WTO rules, but today's announcement shows they do so only when it's convenient to them." A year ago, the World Trade Organization ruled in a similar fashion in favor of the United States, allowing it to impose penalties on European Union goods worth up to $7.5 billion over European support for Boeing's rival, Airbus. After Donald Trump imposed tariffs on EU steel and aluminium and threatened punitive duties on European cars, the Europeans had hoped that he would hold fire on the tariffs relating to the Airbus-Boeing dispute. But having repeatedly failed to achieve a negotiated solution, the EU decided to announce punishment of its own. The EU Commission Executive Vice President Valdis Dombrovskis said, "We call on the United States to agree that both sides drop existing countermeasures with immediate effect so that we can quickly put this issue behind us." Dombrovskis declined to provide precise details of the tariffs, which were to be made public in the official EU journal in near future, but said they would hit agricultural and industrial products, amongst other sectors. Dombrovskis said, "We're not escalating anything, we're exercising our rights." He added, "The EU is mirroring the US approach in the kinds of duties it is imposing." Germany's economy minister Peter Altmaier said, This step was logical, and that most of the 27 EU member countries agreed with it. Asked why the European Union didn't wait until the new US President Joe Biden takes office, Altmaier said, "The US tariffs have already been valid for over a year. We won't know until about February or March exactly who in the new administration has the power to speak for this important area. So a solution had to be found now in the hope that it can prevent a further escalation." The Europeans are hopeful that the US administration's hardline trade stance will soften when next President Joe Biden takes office in January. Dombrovskis welcomed Joe Biden's purported commitment to international alliances, the multilateral system, and to improving ties with the European Union, expressing hope for more rules-based and less conflictual transatlantic ties. The German finance minister Altmaier said most European countries see US media projected victory of Joe Biden as an opportunity for us to take a new approach to our trade relationship and to solve the trade conflicts we have with the United States. In terms of tariffs over Boeing, the European Union had earlier released a preliminary list that suggests it could go after a wide range of US products. The Europeans remained reluctant to ramp up trade tensions with Washington as the coronavirus pandemic ravages economies around the world. Some 16 million workers on both sides have jobs that are supported by transatlantic trade, the biggest such relationship in the global economy. Even before the pandemic hit, tit-for-tat tariffs over the past 4 years have affected companies and people making and selling a whole host of goods. Boeing itself said last month that it will cut 7,000 more jobs as the coronavirus smothers demand for new aircraft and pushed it to a loss. Peter Chase, a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund think tank, says the Europeans should have waited a few months more. Peter Chase said they don't need to do this now. They don't need to disrupt trade. He said the next US president is going to have a lot of constraints and is going to have to work first on domestic issues, both the COVID-19 crisis and the economy, and is going to have to do a lot of internal healing. And I think that they should cut him some slack, basically. Meanwhile, a top French diplomat, Foreign Minister Yves Le Drian, says the European Union and the United States would not return to the previous close relationship they enjoyed prior to Donald Trump's presidency, even with probable election of Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told Europe One Radio, "We will not return to the status quo ante, to the good old days of the transatlantic relationship." Le Drian added, "The world has moved on after these 4 years. Europe has emerged from its naivete, and it is beginning to assert itself as a power. However, some analysts claim a possible Joe Biden presidency is a drastic relief for European officials who have struggled to maintain good relations with Washington over the past 4 years, which sent the ties to an unprecedented low level. They say that the former Vice President, Joe Biden, has already an extensive network of contacts across Europe from his 8 years in President Barack Obama's administration." A defense analyst and advisor to the Foundation for Strategic Research in Paris, François Isbourg, said, "Everybody knows him. He claimed, the good news is that we will be able to have an adult relationship again with people speaking with each other rather than past each other," adding, "Joe Biden is not only an adult person, but a rather rational one." François Hisbourg said, "You have to assume things can turn around in 2024, he added. "This Republican Party had 4 million more votes than last time, with the most dysfunctional candidate you can imagine." Donald Trump has pursued somewhat hostile and inconsistent policies towards Europe during his tenure. he decided to withdraw the U.S. from the Global Paris Climate Accord, a decision that took effect recently. He also terminated the U.S. relationship with and funding to the World Health Organization, WHO, amid the coronavirus pandemic. Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, reached after years of negotiations between Tehran and the world powers, provoked reaction from Brussels. The Republican president also sparked controversy when he started complaining that Washington was spending too much on defending Europe and threatened to pull the United States out of NATO, the military alliance of the West's security for the past 70 years. Donald Trump has once called the EU a foe, saying that they have really taken advantage of us. Such remarks prompted EU leaders, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, to warn that the European Union could no longer trust Washington. Brussels is well aware that some core objectives of Joe Biden's trade policy are unlikely to differ substantially from Donald Trump's. On the campaign trail, Biden promised to boost U.S. manufacturing, to strengthen rules forcing federal agencies to buy U.S. goods, and to impose extra taxes on companies looking to take their supply chains offshore. Sources of tension will persist after Inauguration Day for the next U.S. president. EU diplomats acknowledge that extensive work will be needed to solve the aircraft dispute and that potential flashpoints are looming, not least because of the determination of France and some other European Union nations to hit US tech giants with higher taxes. But the strong hope within the European Union is that under a possible Biden presidency, and if he is confirmed by legal institutions as the next US president, the Union will be treated as a partner rather than a threat, and that common cause can be found in defending the international system of rules-based trade. One EU diplomat said a return to the old normal of life before the Trump presidency is not on the cards, adding, but at the same time, the US will remain an indispensable trade partner for the European Union. The same is true the other way around. EU officials emphasized that the bloc wants the U.S. to help save the World Trade Organization and the system it represents from terminal decline. For the moment, the World Trade Organization, WTO, does not even have a director general, with the Trump administration refusing to join other WTO members in backing Nigeria's Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala for the job. One focus of European Union ministers' discussion on Monday, 9th of November, was the cooperation in dealing with China. The EU shares US concerns about technology transfer conditions placed on companies operating in China and the advantages enjoyed by the country's state-owned enterprises. Whilst there was some joint EU-US work during Trump's tenure, notably the crafting of a trilateral position with Japan on how the WTO should tackle industrial subsidies, Brussels sees the potential to go much further. European Union officials said one promising and vital avenue for cooperation was on the protection of emerging technologies and related implications for national security. Both the European Union and the United States have grappled with security concerns around dependence on Chinese telecommunication company Huawei for fifth-generation networks and have sought to manage their risks posed by takeovers of cutting-edge companies. There have been signals from the Biden campaign that it foresees benefits from cooperation in this area too, with campaign officials citing the need to strengthen coordination with Europe on screening of foreign investments and intelligence sharing on potential commercial threats. Dombrovskis had already been exploring with the Trump administration the idea of a European Union-United States Trade and Technology Council to manage some of this work. A related priority is to find common cause with the United States on modernizing trade rules. That would include work at the World Trade Organization on e-commerce, as well as fashioning a stable solution for companies to transfer data between the European Union and the United States. Luisa Santos, Deputy Director General at lobby group Business Europe, said the most pressing urgent issue for transatlantic trade relations was solving the Airbus-Boeing dispute, but the second was data flows. Previous European Union efforts to negotiate data sharing agreements with the United States have withered under scrutiny from the European Court of Justice, which found violations of the bloc's strict privacy laws. Luisa Santos said a good balance between the data privacy and data sharing is essential for transatlantic supply chains. Dombrovskis said it was a period of extraordinary turbulence, adding, "So we need to keep our friends close and maintain those alliances that really count."
Around the world with reporters. On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland, and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world. And that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon's Martyr Day, Sayyid Nasrallah said the talks were instead meant to be technical and set limits so Lebanon can benefit from its natural resources.
Many have written that the maritime border negotiations would pave the way for normalization between Lebanon and Israel. This is empty talk. We will never be a part of any peace talks with Israel. We consider its existence to be cancerous and devilish, and this will never change.
Sayyid Nasrallah also commented on recent Israeli drills along the Lebanese borders, calling it a demonstration of strength the resistance has established. He said such exercises proved the Israeli army was in a difficult state, where it has shifted its activities from attacking to defending. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Hezbollah has strong, lifelong powers that will help it overcome any Israeli maneuver against Lebanon and guarantee victory in the region. He also made similar remarks towards the U.S. administration. Commenting on the U.S. presidential elections, Sayyid Nasrallah said he was happy at President Donald Trump's, quote, humiliating downfall. However, he said America's foreign policy will stay in favor of Israel, despite a new administration. In regards to the recent U.S. sanctions against Lebanese officials, including Gibran Basil, Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. is seeking to cause political chaos in the country and remove the resistance force from the region. He stressed the plan was doomed to fail.
What gives a government like the American one which commits all sorts of terrorism and corruption, the right to label our politicians as corrupt and sanction them. We need to act upon our sovereignty and stand up against those American policies.
Syed Nasrallah said the U.S. has failed its many attempts to pressure the resistance and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah through the war in Syria and the economic crisis in Lebanon.
These sanctions will do nothing. They will not affect internal relations or cause conflict in Lebanon. The U.S. has been trying for years to cause inner rivalry. It has tried to weaken the strongest component in Lebanon, which is the resistance. This U.S. failure is a victory for the resistance and the Lebanese people.
For his part, Syed Nasrallah praised Lebanese officials, including Minister Basil, for their courageous stance against the U.S. pressure, saying it was for the sake of the nation. Rana Alaeddin, Beirut.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back-and-forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
We had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new border crossing in Rimdan Gebit between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud. It remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration and Afghan Taliban in early this year. The huge financial and military losses in the 19 years long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Clerics from major monotheistic religions gathered here in Tehran for an important goal: to promote peace based on religious commonalities. Delegates representing Islam, Christianity, and Judaism unanimously agreed that the root cause of intolerance and extremism lies in the lack of dialogue among religious leaders.
The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. The Holy Quran has a special chapter about Saint Mary and Moses. So religions don't have any issues with each other.